From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This year, State of Belief is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcasts from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. So much of that work has only been possible thanks to the generous support of our listeners. Now, if you've made a donation this week, thank you, thank you, thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. Do it today. Happy Easter to all who celebrate. May this Christian observance of new beginnings and sacred hope bring some lightness into what continues for so many to be a dark time indeed. Joining in that observance, we'll dedicate this week's show to bringing you some of the most uplifting stories from our 15 years of continuous broadcasting.
We have a tagline, beyond artist-driven, a pop-up, and everyone-friendly, we also have God-optional, which we sometimes substitute for BYOG, bring your own God. And when we use liturgy, we use a gender-neutral version of God. We talk about the divine in very post-feminist and modern and open ways that lets everybody feel the sense of spirit in a way that she or he can really relate to.
Moment, there are going to be some people, of course, who argue that racism is over. You got a black man in the White House. Well, that's ridiculous. We know racism is covert. It's institutional, 400 years of a historic legacy, so that it will continue. But it is still a new moment because, of course, one cannot deny progress in terms of a black man being in the White House.
The whole basis of Western civilization is, I think, the Judeo-Christian ethic. And that's an ethic that is very humanistic and is based on concern for human suffering and very much based on people being concerned, like Jesus was, with the problems of this world.
And people are saying, you know, Muslims aren't loyal. They're, you know, trying to impose Sharia. They're doing this and that. And I thought, you know, like, we've always been saying, you know, Muslims are not terrorists, but we're not saying who we are as Muslims, you know. So I felt this was an adequate response to, I guess, Islamophobia. Like, that's, like, in Europe, in the U.S., like, wherever it is. Like, I just felt it was a good effort in terms of highlighting the, you know, the accomplishments Muslims were making around the world.
Recently, readers of the New York Times were introduced to Lab Shul, an experimental Jewish gathering taking place in what the paper called a pop-up synagogue. Leading this experiment in Jewish spirituality is rabbinical student Amichai Lowell Levy, and I am so happy to have him join us right now on State of Belief Radio. Amichai, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about Lab Shul. The Times quote you as saying the project is still in the beta stage, so tell us what that means, too.
Lab Shul is an artist-driven congregation that was created over the last few years by a whole bunch of us who were seeking a new way to worship, to study, to experiment with the sacred. We all come from Jewish backgrounds and very different backgrounds. And we wanted an experience that is aesthetic and sophisticated and speaks to who we are today, people across the spectrum of 20s to 50s. And we, like many others, recognize that the current offering of many religions don't quite speak to the zeitgeist of the digital and the disconnected and the eager. So Lab Shul is an expression of all these expressions. It's a way to try out old things and reinvent the synagogue for the 21st century.
Is it a congregation that gathers physically, or is it a congregation that gathers technologically, or is it both?
It is all of the above. We go by the pop-up model, which means we do have events going on in New York City, which is our home base. We don't use an actual brick-and-mortar sanctuary. We go to different places, a winery, a gallery, museum, school, so we can be in different areas and reach different audiences. We do quite a bit online. I just completed a pre-Passover training course via a webinar. We have a lot of interaction with people on different digital outlets. But at the end of the day, we want to be together. Mm-hmm. We feel that what spirituality has to offer the digital age is hand-holding and singing and being in the same place.
You recently organized an observance that was called the Last Seder, and I've been eager to ask about that.
We have about 2,000 to 3,000 people joining us on the Jewish High Holidays. We have a few hundred joining us once a month for our Shabbat programs. A lot of those people are from interfaith families, whether they are Jewish and Christian, Jewish and Muslim, etc., and other. And we feel called to create programs that really speak to who we are. So we wanted to create a Passover Easter program that honors both holidays, honors spring, finds a mutual narrative between the two holidays. And it so happened that we were on Holy Saturday, and that for the Passover week, this was the moment in which the Hebrews would have been on the shores of the Sea of Reeds. So we co-created a narrative which was about waiting for the news about Jesus and waiting for figuring out how to cross the sea, and working with various leaders from the Christian faith and a bunch of us from the Jewish faith, we created a musical worship and a storytelling ritual that invited both congregations and a lot of guests to wait with us on the shores. It was a very powerful Saturday morning. We had about 200 people. And we're very moved.
Amichai, you come from a long line of Jewish religious leaders, I understand. How does that inform the work that you're doing today?
Well, I would say that I'm very privileged to have been born into a family that is very Jewishly knowledgeable and literate and carries the legacy of generations. With that responsibility, I feel the need to share these privileges with others who are seeking a way into Judaism, a way that is inclusive, that is celebratory, that is universal, that is positive. And with that legacy of a very orthodox and at times rigid Judaism, I want to reach a new generation where we're more flexidox or polydox than orthodox, more welcoming of other people of faith, more welcoming of other sexual choices, certainly egalitarian. So in this relay race, I feel I've inherited this rabbinic baton, and I am owning it, and I want to pass it on with new sensitivities.
Is this, when you talk about relating tradition to modernity and taking into account the changes that have gone on for all of us in religion, is it a matter of substance that's different, or is it a matter of style, or is it a methodology? In other words, is it a change in theology, or is it a change in ritual and practice?
I think it must be all of the above to some degree. We at Labshul have a tagline, beyond artist-driven, a pop-up, and everyone-friendly, we also have God-optional, which we sometimes substitute for BYOG, bring your own God. And when we use liturgy, we use a gender-neutral version of God. We talk about the divine in very post-feminist and modern and open ways that lets everybody feel the sense of spirit in a way that she or he can really relate to. So on the one hand, this is marketing talk. On the other hand, this is deeply theological. Mm-hmm. For what is the process theology that we are now dealing with? That has to do with how we read scripture, with how we open people to pray. At the core of where we are in the 21st century is an invitation to reimagine what we've inherited and make it accessible. That also means changing some of the hard drive and some of the hard concepts that are at the core of the mythology and the vocabulary.
Isolate, if you will, for me, some of the elements in your work that you would see as specific to your own life experiences and to being in New York City in 2014.
Interesting. Well, Labshul started off as a theater company called Storytelling that was founded 15 years ago by myself and a bunch of wonderful artists. And our goal was to take the stories of Scripture and position them as interactive theater so that there will be more biblical literacy and more empowerment to challenge status quo. So out of the theater company emerged a congregation. Every time we create this sophisticated alternative arena for worship, we are guided by these theatrical concepts. And we're in New York City, which is a theater town. So we are really careful in the aesthetic and the consistent feel of the suspension of disbelief when we create a container for spiritual experience. So the way we tell Scripture is still modified by our methodology, which is very theatrical and interactive, but it's not a performance. Everybody is in it. Mm-hmm. Those elements are very critical to us.
How do you treat the idea of Israel as the chosen people?
Ooh, landmine. I'll share with you my honest personal view on this. I think, like many things that we've inherited that must be looked at carefully, I think the chosen notion has been with us as a protective shield for thousands of years, and I'm not convinced that it's our best shield moving forward.
I see.
I think we're chosen with other people. In fact, one of the liturgy changes we've made is when people chant the blessing as we enter the Torah, the scriptural element of our worship, the traditional blessing is thanking God for having chosen us from other people. And we've made a tiny shift that says for having chosen us with other people. Honoring all traditions, honoring all faith, grateful and proud of our legacy, but we are just one seat at the table.
When did the dime drop? When did the light come on? And you say, I've got to get in this search for new forms of religious expression in a community setting.
Well, I think a bunch of dimes dropped over the years, but I would say one of the main ones was when I was in my late teens, and I realized that, and to be honest with myself, I need to come out as a gay man. Back in Israel in the 80s, it was not as easy as it is today. And I was looking at the Bible. I grew up as a religious Jew, and I thought, there's a mistake here. Either the book is wrong and God is wrong, or I'm wrong, and I didn't feel wrong. So I was looking for a way to reconcile who I thought I was becoming with who I was groomed to become. Mm-hmm. And that was what caused me to take a closer look at the Bible and look at commentary and the oral tradition and understand that there are 70 facets to Torah, and that there are many ways of expressing one's love of God and religion, and that I'm not necessarily of the Orthodox kind. And I will need to spend my life finding new solutions and creative alternatives. And it's been that way ever since.
So these experiments in organized religion, we probably should put a sticker on it that says could be dangerous, because I can't imagine that you start looking at these experiments and not risk major change in your own life.
I think the main change is the expansion of vulnerability. And what I am so humbled by again and again, and with our shift from theater to worship, is that we offer ourselves and other people the safe container, a sanctuary, to be vulnerable. And that's dangerous.
Yes.
So that's real. That's emotions. Every time I'm there helping to co-lead these performance events and these moments of worship, I cry. And if I don't cry, I feel like I didn't do my job. And I cry because it's from the heart, and I allow other people to be in this vulnerable place. And that's dangerous because it's real. And if we wouldn't be doing that, then we're just chewing and churning old words that our ancestors gave us and do a checklist on are you religious and go home. Being there, done that.
Okay, what would you like to see Lab Shul evolve into?
I really want us to go from the model that people know of having a rabbi and a cantor and a teacher and a presenter to a real circle of co-creators. We already have some of it, but I want more of it. So we understand, all of us, the responsibility and the role we have in being there for each other and creating a robust community that can stand up to the challenges of modern times.
Tell us, if you will, how our listeners can learn more about this whole movement and what you're doing with this very creative approach to religion.
Please check us online, www.labshul.org. We blog constantly. We invite people to contribute, to join us, to support us. We are very young, and we hope to grow to be still young and very old.
Today, 7 years after that story first aired, Labshul is going strong. An artist-driven, everybody-friendly, God-optional, pop-up experimental community for sacred Jewish gatherings based in NYC, reaching the world. Amichai holds the title of founding spiritual leader. He received his rabbinical ordination from the Jewish Theological Seminary of America in 2016.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Coming up, more of our favorite inspiring stories from the past. You're listening to the best of State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy.
As so many communities in our nation look with hope to the promise of the Biden administration, it's useful to remember what that was like back in 2008, as the election of Barack Obama and Joe Biden was still only a possibility. From the weekend before Election Day, here's a bit of conversation between Welton and Harvard professor Cornel West, bringing his characteristic blend of hope and warning.
Few people have written, thought, or spoken about the topic of race and democracy as frequently and prolifically as my next guest, Dr. Cornel West. Dr. West is a professor of African American Studies and Religion at Princeton University. He's the author of several books, including Race Matters and Democracy Matters. His newest book, hitting bookstores as we speak, is called Hope on a Tightrope. I first met Cornel West at the Ford Foundation in New York and then again on a plane to my hometown, Monroe, Louisiana. And I am very happy to get to speak with him once again. Cornel West, welcome to State of Belief.
Oh, what a blessing for me to be here. And I just want to salute you and the wonderful work you do, my brother.
Cornel, how do you feel about the way race has been handled in this presidential election? Obama's candidacy could have given us an opportunity for a real conversation about race. Are we experiencing that, or have we just seen the worst in America, the racism, the division?
No, I think we could have seen much, much worse. And, of course, we've seen the worst here or there. The two sick white brothers just the other day threatened to assassinate Brother Barack and kill some precious black youth in Tennessee. But we could have seen more of that. I think it's very difficult, if not impossible, to have a substantive discussion about race at the same time a black man's running for president. So I think that Brother David Axelrod and Brother David Plouffe, let alone Brother Barack himself, decided that they wanted to hold the issues of race at arm's length as much as possible. And they were able to do that with that one exception, of course, with Brother Jeremiah Wright. Mm-hmm. But I think the issues of race is just such an explosive issue and difficult dilemma that it's hard to connect that with a black man running for president and it not tarnish his call into question the possibility of him winning.
What happens if Barack Obama wins? What happens to race relations in America?
Well, I think it's new terrain and unknown territory. It's going to be a very, very different moment. There are going to be some people, of course, who argue that racism is over. You got a black man in the White House. Well, that's ridiculous. We know racism is covert. It's institutional, 400 years of a historic legacy, so that it will continue. But it is still a new moment because, of course, one cannot deny progress in terms of a black man being in the White House. On the other hand, people are going to say, well, there's no change at all. I don't know why you're getting so excited. It's just another president happens to be black. Well, no, that's not true either. All you need to do is look in the eyes of young folk, especially young black folk. Lo and behold, they've now got an image. They've got a powerful role model of somebody committed to public service. rather than there's some of their heroes who often are tied to materialism, hedonism, and narcissism. So that it's hard to say. I can't really predict. I just know that we're going to have to rethink. We're going to have to renew and recast and revise our understandings of how race connects to class, genders, empire, and so on.
Okay, same perspective. What happens if Barack Obama loses?
Yeah, I hate to think about that, though, brother.
I know you do, but what happens?
Well, one is that the extension of conservative rule, I mean, Brother John McCain is a catastrophic response to a catastrophic situation. Probably the beginning of the end of American empire, brother. I mean, this is bad, bad, bad news. Because right now, you know, we've got two wars. That's almost like World War II. We've got near depression like the 30s. We have unbelievable racial polarization like the 60s, all at the same time. And so I just wonder whether American democracy can stand another 4 years of conservative rule. Now, I don't want to sound apocalyptic, but that's why it's so hard to think of. We got too many precious human beings and fellow citizens, namely all of them in the country, who can easily go under with that kind of myopic, short-sighted, cold-hearted, mean-spirited rule that would be another 4 years under Republicans.
Cornell, you're a very smart man in many different ways. Let's say you're interviewing Cornell West and you want to hear the best of what he's got to say at this moment. What question do you ask Cornell West that I haven't asked you?
I think I would ask, what is the source of what keeps you going?
That's what I want to ask, is what is the source of what keeps you going?
And my answer would be that I'm a love child, brother. I receive indescribable love from my mother and father and my church and my teachers, and that I am who I am because of that deep, deep, deep love from Zaytoun, my daughter, Cliff, my son, and that kind of grace, because these are gifts given to me. I don't deserve it. I don't earn it. It just comes my way. That kind of grace is wind at my back. And so even if I wanted to run to the crack house, I couldn't get there because that love wind just pushed me the other way.
So I take it you're a hopeful person.
Full of hope, but not optimistic. I'm a blues man. Blues, neither optimistic nor pessimistic, but prisoner of hope. I've been down so long, down don't worry me no more. That's why I keep keeping on. Whatever catastrophe comes my way, I can endure it with grace and dignity if you just give me a chance to keep on moving and keep pushing like Curtis Mayfield taught us.
Dr. Cornell West is professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton University, author of a new book, Hope on a Tightrope. Cornell, it's been great talking with you. Thanks.
What a blessing, my brother. And you stay strong. What a force for good you are. And it's so good to see you on a plane on the way to Louisiana a little while ago.
Talk to you soon.
Stay strong, my brother.
Bye-bye. There's more of our favorite conversations coming right up. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to the best of State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. My next guest grew up attending a Christian school, but became an atheist even before graduating. But instead of closing the door to seeing any value in religion and faith, he spent a lifetime of examining scripture and religious teachings, contrasting the historical Jesus with the manifestations of Christianity seen in today's world. Christian humanism is a great contribution to this whole discussion. Tom Drake Brockman joins us now from Australia, where he makes his home. And Tom, I welcome you to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Tom, is it fair to say that your book argues that, in a sense, Christianity is destroying religion?
Maybe I wouldn't go that far, but I think the way it's being practiced is not what Jesus intended. And I've got a very specific idea of what he was wanting to do, and it was far more focused on this world than Christianity actually believes. Conventional Christianity is based on the afterlife and what happens to our eternal souls. So certainly Jesus was concerned about that. But my contention is that everything he said and did indicated that the path to salvation lay through our attitudes and our actions in this world and how we responded to human suffering in particular, the way he did.
When do you think that change began to happen? Was it almost as soon as Jesus was no longer among us that the early church began to change to an otherworldly vision rather than a this-worldly vision?
I think it all started with St. Paul, quite frankly. One of the main points I make in the book is that very early Christians were very much what they call the Jewish Christians, led by St. James, who was the brother of Jesus, and the apostles, in fact, who were his intimate friends. And they had quite a different view. I think the conventional Christianity tries to cover up the differences between Paul and James, but Paul was basically focused on a different agenda. He wanted to make Jesus into the Christ, you know, the Redeemer, and he developed this idea after his epiphany on the road to Damascus. He developed this idea that Jesus, his death on the cross, was a sacrificial act that earned the human race salvation. Now, that's not the way the James and the other apostles saw it. Quite, they saw him as being certainly chosen by God and son of God, if you like, the Messiah. But they didn't believe the act of crucifixion had achieved salvation.
Right.
In itself. They had a very different view. Yeah.
I think a lot of religious people could learn a great deal from what you're writing. However, many of the people that I think could benefit from what you write probably would not read over maybe 5 or 6 pages of the book, and then they would close the book. And my interest is, what would you say to those people who don't want to even hear or read what your thoughts are? What would you say to them about the importance of dialogue? Because this is by no means an angry book that you've written.
I'd say to them to look at what's happening with Christianity throughout the world. I know in the United States it's holding ground, but when you look at Europe, I think they should be quite alarmed about the decline of Christianity. And the situation that Europe is in at the moment is, I think, in a lot of ways directly linked to that. The whole basis of Western civilization is, I think, the Judeo-Christian ethic. And that's an ethic that is very humanistic and is based on concern for human suffering and very much based on people being concerned, like Jesus was, with the problems of this world. And when that's dying, then Western civilization tends to die with it. And I think in Europe it is. It's quite alarming, the decline of Christianity. They should look at that and start asking some real questions and challenge themselves. You just can't continue, you know, particularly if it does start to decline, as I think it will in the United States.
Let's follow that line of thought. And if Christianity is, in fact, dying, as you say, that is Christianity as we know it, what are the different possible scenarios for what happens next in your mind?
I think it's the likelihood is that it will dwindle out in Europe and in most of the developed world, but it has got a strong growth in the developing world, particularly in Africa and parts of Asia as well. But the growth there is very much kind of along the lines of a very reactionary, fundamentalist, literal kind of interpretation of the Bible and the Gospels. and it's ultra-conservative, and some of the aspects of that are quite disturbing. I think, you know, the way there's elements of the church, in particularly in Africa, which is homophobic, intolerant, it's like the extremist Islam, really, in very many respects. And so that's certainly one major scenario, that it'll almost disappear in Western countries and remain strong in developing countries that be driven by very extreme kind of fundamentalist fanatics who will ultimately end up destroying it, you know.
Yes.
These people have had control in the past, and they've been very destructive in an age where, if we live in a freer world and a developing world, then it's likely to prove destructive again. The fruits of their actions, you know.
Yes.
As Jesus said, you can tell by the way people manifest, you know, what they actually do in terms of society and the well-being of the world. You can tell whether they're on the right track or not, and that was his yardstick. And I think that will ultimately result in Christianity totally declining worldwide over a long period of time, perhaps.
Yeah. You are saying that humanism is closer to the Jesus ideal than the faith that we call Christianity as it is practiced today. And that also means that there is a difference between what is the Christianity that we experience in culture today and the Christianity that you find and I find described in the Gospels and the Scriptures. Now, having said that, Tom, what is the process, as you see it, of reconnecting that original faith and that original spirit of Jesus with what goes on as Christianity today?
I think it's going to be very difficult to do it. The proof of the pudding is in the eating, and I think that's the position that Jesus took. You know, by your deeds you will know them. You know, you'll be able to assess whether something is good or decent or not by the fruit it produces, by the results that it actually achieves in this world. And that's what he's talking about. You know, he's talking about a very real thing, not just some kind of subjective spiritual thing that, you know, individuals might know, but the world can see whether something has really got the right thing going for it. That's the thing. I think if people started practicing this kind of humanist Christianity, I feel confident that it would achieve results. It's not based on secular humanism. It's based on a particular type of humanism. It doesn't follow traditional lines, which a lot of these kind of humanistic or social gospel kind of theories pursue, like liberation theology, for example. It is definitely not a left-wing position that I'm putting forward here, and nor is it a right-wing one. It's a position that takes the most urgent cases of human suffering and focuses in on those and looks for solutions. It really focuses on critical issues, particularly relating to children and women to a large extent, where, you know, child protection, for example, how to stop children being, you know, injured by abusers, whether they're people like Joseph Kony or pedophiles or whatever, and prioritizing those kind of things and getting results, which I think you would if you had a critical mass of people practicing Christianity along those lines and really zeroed in on those extremely urgent issues that Jesus, as Jesus was. I think there would be real changes in the world, and those changes would then reflect a truth and a fundamental kind of validity to the whole concept of Jesus sort of following that direction.
I'm curious as to how you see other faith traditions playing into this. For example, Judaism or Islam or some of the other religions on the world stage. What's their role in this?
Well, I see them all as potentially united. I did discover quite a bit about Judaism I didn't realize before when I investigated this aspect of Jesus' teachings, but the other religions I only have a superficial knowledge of, so I can't really be too definite. But my distinct impression is that God would not have created a world where the five great religious traditions, you know, Hinduism, Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, and Islam, were all completely at odds or pursuing, you know, individual kind of goals towards a particular sort of spiritual idea or a godhead that was quite distinct and different. I think they're all cultural manifestations of a same idea, and that idea is very humanistic, very spiritually humanistic, and that's the point I'm making. If you look at four of those great traditions, really, I think it's quite clear that Jesus distilled the real wisdom of Judaism, mm-hmm. and he epitomized that, not by being separate from Judaism, as a lot of Christians used to think historically and still do today, that he came to abolish Judaism and put his own religion in its place. He came to highlight the intensely beautiful humanistic aspects of Judaism and show how important they were compared to the legalistic way that the leaders of the Jewish religion at his time were practicing it, mm-hmm. in a very pedantic, legalistic and negative way, destructive way. In fact, they were very corrupt. The leaders of the Jewish religion back in the first century. Similarly, Buddha did the same thing. There are parallels between Buddha and Jesus are more than remarkable. They're quite stunning. It was an incredible book that every Christian should read if they've got any interest in opening their minds at all. And it's called The Original Jesus, The Buddhist Sources of Christianity, by two authors, Gruber and Kirsten. Mm-hmm. And in there you can see that what Buddha was doing, among many other things, was almost identical to Christ. He was fighting against the corrupted religious leadership of Hinduism, which was led by these Brahmins who were very similar to the Sadducees and the Pharisees that were corrupted mm-hmm. in Jesus' time. They were also corrupted in the 4th century BC India. He was struggling against them, trying to distill the best humanistic values of Hinduism mm-hmm. In a way which was strikingly similar to Christ. Their teachings about human suffering and compassion and so on were so alive as to be almost word for word. In many cases, it's quite staggering. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, there is a real possibility of a world religion. Right. Islam, I don't really know much about it. I'm sure there are humanistic Muslims who could produce a similar theory, similar ideas about Muhammad and what he taught. Now that's been distorted.
The fact is that you seem to know more about the Christian scriptures and historic Christianity than a lot of people who have been in Christianity for a long time. I've been speaking with Tom Drake Brockman, author of the thought-provoking new book, Christian Humanism.
That conversation first aired in June of 2012. Thomas Drake Brockman published a second book in 2019 titled Bad Faith, A Spiritual Humanist Alternative for Christianity and the West. He passed away suddenly on November 3, 2020, at his home in Sydney, Australia.
Few things are as easy to manipulate into hate as is ignorance. And there is abundant evidence of conscious efforts to foment anti-Muslim hatred in this country. To help counter the ignorance that too many Americans continue to have regarding followers of Islam, an eye-opening look at inspiring Muslim lives has just been launched, and I am so glad. It's a website, MuslimHeroes.org, and the founder of that website joins me now on State of Belief. Saud Inam, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Reverend Gaddy.
I am making assumptions about your motivation, so I think I would like for you to talk about what inspired this project and explain what it is.
The project I kind of came up with post the Park 51 incident.
Uh-huh.
And I was kind of tired, it's been like 11 years since 9/11. Right. And seeing the same rhetoric over and over from Islamophobes and people who have agendas against Islam and Muslims and basically have this industry targeting Muslims and making them to be disloyal Americans and, just making them look very anti-Western, that type of thing. And I saw the same rhetoric happening over and over, and the Park 51 incident essentially, highlighted for me in the sense of seeing that over and over the message was getting out, and people were saying, Muslims aren't loyal, they're, trying to impose Sharia, they're doing this and that. And I thought, we've always been saying, Muslims are not terrorists, but we're not saying who we are mm-hmm. as Muslims, So I felt this was an adequate response to, Islamophobia. like that's like in Europe, in the U.S., like wherever it is. Like I just felt it was a good effort in terms of highlighting the accomplishments Muslims were making around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, it was just like a response to that incident, and it kind of like built up into a bigger project, which I was not expecting.
I see. Well, that's a good thing. The name of the project, MuslimHeroes.org, how do you make decisions about the individuals to include on the site?
Well, for me, there's a problem in the Muslim community where there are certain groups within the Muslim community that kind of have their own images of, you know, heroes and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And, like, they may look at, you know, certain, individuals who are, like, not so peaceful in their mm-hmm. I guess, their ways. As heroes, right? So, mm-hmm. like, I essentially wanted to, you know, show the youth, like, and also, you know, to a certain extent, the Muslim community that, you know, we have positive role models out there who do, you know, engage in government affairs and policy making and, you know, sports, arts, music, that type of thing. And there's, like, I just wanted to show the diversity of thought, you know, and diversity mm-hmm. of, I guess, careers that are out there. So in a sense, like, you know, I just thought the idea would be to create a different dynamic in terms of like the mindset of the Muslim community. Like right now, it's kind of like very negative, and you know, like there's basically essentially there's a lot of forces against us. But, you know, there's no hope. There's no, like you know, it's a very negative, very it's like a type of victimization, you could say, of the Muslim community. So I essentially wanted to kind of inspire people to think in a more positive manner,
mm-hmm.
And try to think that there is hope for the world and like you know the Muslim community to be included in American mainstream and to a certain extent worldwide in like you know the international context.
So tell us some of your favorite profiles on MuslimHeroes.org.
I think one of my most favorite one is probably Rashad Sultan Khan. He was actually a soldier who died in Iraq. And I think his story was extremely powerful to me because, you know, over and over in the media, you know, like Islamophobes say Muslims are not loyal. They're anti-Western. They're anti-U.S. They don't uphold democratic values, that type of thing. And, like, when I first heard about Kareem Rashad Sultan Khan, I was extremely inspired by the words Colin Powell said on NBC, he said, you know, what's wrong with a Muslim child wanting to be the president of the U.S. or running for Congress? So just to see that was a very, very powerful thing for me because, like, just seeing the Islamophobe rhetoric of saying, you know, Muslims don't serve in the government, they're, you know, trying to undermine Western values, that type of thing. I think his story is very inspirational, very powerful when I had heard about it. And I said, you know, this guy has to be on my list of Muslim heroes because he is essentially a beacon of light that shows, you know, the true nature, the true loyalty of Muslims and how they can be productive citizens and can serve in the military and ultimately make the ultimate sacrifice for the country.
Yeah.
So I think he was probably like my most favorite Muslim hero.
What kind of responses are you getting so far?
Right now, I mean, like, I think there has been, you know, a kind of buzz. When I first started the project, people were, like, really excited about it, and they were really, like, inspired by some of the people that I put up, because, like, a lot of these people, like, are not well-known. They're mm-hmm. not well-known in the community. Like, they're, like, they're the more well-known Muslim Americans in the U.S., you know, Imam Majid, Imam Suhaib Webb, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, Imam Zaid Shaker, but I think for me, it was, I think people are kind of inspired to see that there are Muslims who are not as well known
mm-hmm.
that are doing great work at a grassroots level. Like, for example, there's a free healthcare clinic out in California called the Umrah Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And 96 to 97% of their patients are actually non-Muslim.
Hmm.
So they provide a free healthcare clinic. So these guys are doing like great work at a very grassroots level. And like, you know, not a lot of people know about it. When they do learn about it, they're extremely inspired and, like, you know, they're kind of happy to see that this work is being done in the Muslim community.
Well, Saud, if all of these names of these people were household names, you wouldn't need to be doing what you're doing. So I'm glad that you're doing that. How could listeners of this show participate in the project?
They could, essentially, like, post the website on their blogs, share this on the blog post I am looking to launch a video contest either this summer or next summer to kind of inspire people to look for Muslim heroes in their communities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go interview them and like send a video back to us, and we would essentially, you know, like put them on our YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
And the top three finalists, they would get cash prizes and scholarships to kind of, you know, motivate people and like identify heroes in their own community. So I guess that's one way.
Sure.
There are two ways. I guess there's like, I guess spreading the word. There's the Facebook group, Muslim Heroes on Facebook. There's like the website.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a Twitter too. So just, I guess spreading the word would be the best way to get people involved.
What would you like to see this become? MuslimHeroes.org's already gone beyond what you thought it might be. Where would you like for it to go?
Honestly, I think what I'd like Muslim Heroes to become is essentially a resource for Muslims and non-Muslims alike to see that, hey, listen, there are, you know, Muslims out there who are doing great work. We can, you know, work together for a better world. Like, there are people who are, like, you know, basically sacrificing their own personal time just to, you know, serve others,
mm-hmm.
be it Muslim, Jew, Christian, Sikh, Buddhist, Baha'i, you know, like, I think, you know, it's just, I think some of these people are very inspirational, and I'd like to, you know, have it as a resource in terms of providing maybe in the future scholarships for youth to kind of pursue journalism or liberal arts type degrees
mm-hmm.
and kind of think at a higher level. I'd like to also have like leadership camps, essentially town halls in various, you know, major cities to kind of connect Muslim heroes to the broader community and kind of highlight their work and maybe, you know, honor them in an award ceremony of sorts. But yeah, like, I mean, like, there are a bunch of projects that are actually in the works right now that I'm working on. But essentially, I would like to highlight the work these Muslim heroes are doing and also inspire others.
MuslimHeroes.org. I think you'll find it both interesting and valuable. My guest has been the site's founder, Saud Inam. Saud, thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Reverend Gaddy.
While a fascinating resource back in 2012 when we first broadcast this segment, the Muslim Heroes website, like so many online resources created out of love or personal passion, did not survive. Many of the names celebrated in its pages can still be found at the Internet Archive at web.archive.org.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. It's kind of nice looking back at these great stories. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, one person for whom you think this show might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.